Welcome to PCMC Pop Culture Man Children. I'm Mike Bongiorno. Gang, you can hear my voice is a little bit hoarse. I was sick this week. I feel fine now, but my voice is still missing. I like it. It sounds sexy. I'm here today with a very special guest, Mr. Jeff Ryan. He is the author of Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. That's a book I've talked about on the podcast before. I really liked that book, and I learned a lot of stuff I didn't know. And he's also the writer of his latest book, Your Worshipfulness, starring Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia. But he's here today to talk about one of my favorite topics, and I know one of your favorite topics, Mickey Mouse, because he's also the author of a great book, A Mouse Divided, How Oob Iwerks Became Forgotten, and Walt Disney Became Uncle Walt. Jeff Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing great. I was nodding along as you got oob correct, the pronunciation correct. Almost everyone says oob, but you said oob.
I always thought it was oob forever. I mean, for as long as I've known who Ub was. And then when I read the book, you explain it's Oob. And like literally as I read it, it was that thing of like, Ub. No, Oob. I had to like retrain my brain.
Yeah, it's Oob, but Walt called him Ub. Therefore, almost everyone at Disney called him Ub. So whichever way you go, yeah, Pronunciation-wise, you have standing behind you.
Doesn't that say so much about Walt? That he can change your name?
Well, Oob also renamed Walt. When Oob meant Walt, Walt was going as Walter Diz. He liked Diz as the last name.
Yeah.
And Walter was better than Walt. And when they were basically unemployed, hanging out in an art studio, Oob was working on ways of coming up with a good signature for him and figured out that Walt Disney, using his shortened version of his first name but the full of his last name, looked pretty good when he signed it. So Walter Diz became Walt Disney because of Oob Iwerks in a very real way.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're leading me on to my first question, which is, I've read two of your books now and I love them both. And they were both on topics I like and kind of was like, I know everything. And I learned a lot of things. So can you tell me a little bit about your research?
Okay. For most of the books I've written, I have four now. Three of them were on topics I really knew. Like from a kid, I loved this stuff. Yeah. The Mickey Mouse early years of animation, that was the one I didn't know much about.
Oh, wow.
So that's why it took me like 7 years to write this book, because I was going from not knowing very much about it as well. You know, if you put a gun to my head and say, you got to write a book about a professional wrestler, I'll have that thing done in under a year, because I've been watching it since I was a kid. If you say it's got to be Attitude Era, it was like, okay, I have no problem with that.
Right, right.
But if you told me to write a book about ballet, I was like, okay, do you need it this decade? Because
so
I don't know ballet.
If Mickey, what made you pick Mickey then for a topic?
Because I had already written about Super Mario, and the way that Nintendo made Mario famous was by the Mickey Mouse playbook. They took one of their characters, their biggest icon, and they just stamped him everywhere you could possibly stamp him. Every bit of merchandising was there to back up and bolster the name of the company, the identity of the company, and the feeling that this is children's entertainment that's good for the whole family. And that's exactly what Disney did 50 years ago with Mickey Mouse. So I wanted to find out how Walt came up with the Mickey Mouse playbook in the first place.
So interesting. So it's almost like working backwards.
Yeah.
Really,
the Mickey Mouse book is like a prequel almost.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that your books choose to focus on character. Like, it's not Nintendo. I mean, you get at Nintendo, you get at Nintendo of America, but you focus it on Mario. Same thing with this. This is really about this relationship between Oob Iwerks and Walt Disney, but grounded through Mickey as this character. And then you've got the Leia book. What makes you, that's a very interesting way of approaching it, the project.
Yeah, it's the fictional character biography.
Yeah.
Instead of writing a standard Walt Disney biography, I wrote a biography of Mickey Mouse, which means I needed to learn everything about Walt, but put it in just of the stuff that affected Mickey over the years.
Yeah.
So the book ends in 1945. So if you want to find out what happened to Walt after that, about Disneyland, anything like that, sorry, my book can't help you. I just focus on the Mickey of it all.
Yeah, I like The Animated Man. I forget who wrote that.
Michael Barrier. Yes, that's fantastic.
That's a good one. And that book and your book also echoes this. That's where I learned that he's not an anti-Semite, like many people. He's got a lot of bad things that you could say about him. but no proof at all of him being anti-Semitic.
Right. The way I like to explain it is, if you were like a 12-year-old white kid and you love listening to black music, you love singing along to rap music, all of a sudden you have this, well, can I say the words that they're saying? Because, you know, I don't hate black people. I love black people. But can I say this word? And no, you basically can't. You can't say some of the words.
Right.
And Walt was the same way in 1920, because he loved watching vaudeville, and vaudeville was increasingly done by Jewish performers, and they were making Jewish jokes. And if you're Jewish and you're making a Jewish joke, fine. If you're not Jewish and you make a disparaging Jewish joke, that comes off as anti-Semitic, even though you're just quoting one of your idols.
Right, right. It's so interesting. It's really interesting. There's a lot of stuff in the early Mickeys. I mean, Mickey changed both design-wise many times, but also personality-wise, almost to the point where he was refined into not having a personality. Because in the beginning, he's sort of a trickster. He's sort of naughty. He's hurting animals and, you know, kissing people against their will. And he's kind of a little bit of a, like a bad guy, like a lovable bad guy.
Right. Right. He was not designed right off the bat to be the G-rated spokesman of the company. He was made to be an entertaining person. And you watch him the way you watch Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes.
Not like I want to live my life like this way, but, oh, I understand what this guy's going through. Yeah, he's throwing a fit with the barista, but, you know, I've been there too.
Right. Like, life could be hard, but I can make music out of anything. That's sort of like early Mickey, kind of like.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Oob Iwerks. You know, as I was reading your book, I said, you know, let me try something I've never tried. I Googled who created Mickey Mouse. And it said right there on Google, like the front page, Walt Disney and Oob Iwerks. So it's, at least right now, it's not hidden. But it's also like, if I go out in the street and say, hey, do you know who Oob Iwerks is?
Right.
I doubt I'd find anybody who'd say, oh, yeah, that's the co-creator of Mickey Mouse. It's Walt is Mickey. Mickey is Walt. So it's amazing, because it's not the secret information, but it's also not part of our culture.
Right. Now, if you discount the people who think, oh, Walt Disney is great, he personally hand animated every frame of Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. If you take those people away and just focus on like the sane, rational people who realize that Walt was hiring artists to do most of this stuff.
Yeah.
And then you need to define what counts as creating. Is creating drawing the first thing on a piece of paper? Because in that case, it probably was Oob Iwerks, who then saw Walt's bad mouse drawing and said, that's going to take forever to animate and it doesn't look good. I can make a better, more on-model looking mouse if we hypothetically went forward with a mouse as a cartoon. That doesn't take that much work. That takes a professional animator about a half hour. And then do you mean the person who made the first cartoon? In that case, it's definitely Oob, because he drew every frame of the first appearance because all the other animators had quit.
Yes. Yeah. In the you tell this great story. In the beginning, they have a pretty close association where Walt is sort of this idea man. And well, the Disney line that we're sold is Walt is this great idea man, and Roy is this businessman, this money man. But there's a third prong, which is Oob is this master tactician.
Yes, that's a great way of saying it. Yeah, Walt would dream something up and say, we need money to pay for it. We need some way to make this happen because no one has ever done this before. So Roy would come up with the money to pay people for it, and Oob would come up with a way for it to physically happen. A little bit of magic you would never seen before on screen.
And what in the research process, was it hard to find things about Oob?
It was difficult to find stuff about Oob. There's just not that much written about him. Most of his 1930s were spent with a company that failed and is no longer around. So the records of that are very spotty. And then once he rejoined Disney, spoiler alert, he does rejoin Disney at some point and stays there for the rest of his career. Then he's credited for all of his work, but so much of what he brought of value to the company was in being the wise old man that you as an animator, it's like, I am stuck. I can't figure out for my life how to draw this thing. Let me go to Oob and ask him how to draw it. And Oob's like, oh yeah, well, you do this and you do this. And I'm like, wow, you solved my problem. You solved my problem. You shaved 3 days off my cycle. This is amazing.
Yeah. There's a great story in the book about, I think it's Bambi, where they're losing their minds trying to figure out how to do rain in a way that's not super expensive and taking all the time. And then Oob was like, why don't I just film rain on a black background, on the black sky, and then composite that over the image, and it looks amazing.
Yes, because it's real rain. You can't get better than the real thing.
Right. And he's not the very first, but he created a multi-plane camera before Disney was using one.
That's right. Yeah, his was basically used the rack and pinion steering of a sedan, and he used that to have multiple camera frames, like in an old school play where you had the waves in front of the stage. And if you filmed that, then the waves would be kind of fuzzy if you had, you know, your characters in foreground, and then something in the background would be fuzzy also.
He was like a MacGyver. Like, really? He would find these things. He was like a tinkerer.
Yes, he was a fantastic inventor. If you gave him any piece of technology, from a camera to a gun, he would dissemble it, he would reassemble it, he would figure out exactly how it worked, how all of the parts were made, and he'd basically become a smith. So if you went to an Old West town, he's the guy who could fix absolutely anything.
What went wrong? Like, they created Mickey Mouse, which is this huge thing. There are these Mickey Mouse clubs with these kids wearing these terrifying masks, and it's this big popular thing. There are moments in the book, in the narrative that you sort of draw for us, where I find myself kind of almost like in a horror movie going, don't go in there. Like when I believe it's Pat Powers, who is, he was the distributor for
Universal, I think.
Universal, right. He kind of lures Oob away, and Oob is sort of at that point ready to go because Disney's not very kind. Disney doesn't. I think you at one point in the book you say he's never public with praise, but he's never private with insult or something or criticism.
Yes, and when Oob quit, one of the things he said was, "I'm a partner at this company, and you're treating me like an employee."
Yeah.
So the question that I had, which led the whole second half of the book, is if Oob was this great genius and Walt is like a gold brick who's, you know, just putting up his feet and asking other people to do stuff, why isn't Oob the successful one?
Right. Why isn't Flip the Frog something?
Exactly.
I mean, I honestly didn't know Flip until I read your book, and then I went and watched some of it, and it's technically okay. Actually, you know what I liked better than Flip? The second one.
Oh, Willy Whopper?
Yeah, at least Willy Whopper had had good animation, although it's not very interesting.
Yeah,
good premise, although he never really sells the premise that he's a liar.
Yeah.
But I was like, I had never even heard of Flip the Frog.
Okay, my theory about why Walt succeeded and Oob didn't. Are you a Jeopardy guy? Do you watch Jeopardy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the ways that James Holzhauer became one of the great all-time champions on the show was that he was a professional sports bettor before he went on Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
For you or me, putting down a $50,000 bet is like, oh, that's a huge amount of money to lose. Right. I mean, you get a lot to win, but I don't know if I can do that. If you're on Jeopardy, you may have to put down a $50,000 bet. And you have to do it with about 10 seconds worth of knowledge. And most people are too trepidatious to make that bet, and they hold on to the money, and then they bet $3,000 instead, which is as much as they can think to gamble.
Yeah.
And then when they win $3,000. Mm. James has been doing this for a decade, so he has no problem putting the 50 large up, knowing I'm going to get the money back if I win, or if I get the question wrong, then I'll just get the $50,000 by answering some more questions. Walt is James Holzhauer. All through his life, whenever he had money, he threw it on red. He threw it on black. He kept on betting more and more and more. And Oob is not. Right. Oob, if he had a chance to save some money, there were some cartoons he decided he would draw all of it himself just to give the rest of his animators a break. The last thing he would do was go to the bank and say, I want to mortgage my house, everyone else's house, just to get some more money to keep a color cartoon going.
Yeah, when I was reading the book, I kept thinking, I would be Oob. Like, Oob, I think, behaves in a way that's based a little bit on fear of his future and you know, thinking about his self-respect, I would end up like Oob. Because the way Disney, you said, he would gamble all the money. Even if he didn't have money, he'd still be like, let's do this. We don't have money. How about we try it now with color? Or like, he's constantly trying to push when there's even when stuff isn't coming in. I would never be able, I'm somebody who's like, you know, do I get extra avocado at Chipotle today? I don't know if I have the money to do it. Walt is like, hey, you know what? We're going to do a new sound system. So we'll change your theater to be wired to the sound system I want it to be, despite not having money.
Yeah, he was profligate in that. And it was a lifelong bone of contention between him and Roy, because it wasn't his money he was spending. It was ultimately the company's money. But he had no problem writing the paychecks. And eventually he started a whole second company because he couldn't get money out of his own company. So he needed a second company just to fund his dreams for the first company.
Yeah. You think Roy's situation is probably... it's interesting because Roy and Oob are similar, and it's like, I have a good life, but I'm not the star here, so I'm okay stepping back a little bit. Like the Oob that you talk, I wasn't aware that he went back, but the Oob that you talk about who went back and was actually doing a lot during the war and during like the years where they're making training films and propaganda and stuff. He was really making it work when they had a lot of stuff to do and not a lot of resources. He sort of is like this, I don't know, I imagine like this sweet old man who's like, oh, I don't need credit for anything. I'm just happy to be here. People like that, it's almost like Walt is, he's like a cult leader or somebody like Trump or something, like somebody who like, he'll get people to rally behind him.
Yes, and there are people besides the two examples you gave of people with great charisma who are making 100 other people row their boats in the same direction, right, but aren't necessarily rowing them off a waterfall to their doom.
Right.
But there's always a temptation there. What you were saying before about being like content to be an artist, being content to not have the one with the spotlight on you, I think that's something key to both Walt and Oob to understand. Oob didn't necessarily want the spotlight. Oob was a contented person for the most part. And Walt, like most other modern billionaires, was never content. He was always looking for something more. Yeah. And people call that like the dream or the magic, but that's a very positive way of selling. It. The negative side is that this is never someone who went to bed saying, we did a good day's work and proud of what we did. It was always, we could have done better. We could have put more money into this thing. It could have looked better. The next one's going to be like, you know, you go to bed after making Mary Poppins and thinking, yeah, that was only okay. We can do better. We can do twice as good as that.
Yeah. I often think about like, if he hadn't been a heavy chain smoker, he would have kept being obsessed with this idea of the city of the future. And who knows where that really would have brought him? Like, who knows? We could have a different world if he hadn't died when he did.
There have been so many other people like Steve Jobs, who have always dreamed about the city of the future, and it's always bit them in the rear. They've never been able to get it off the ground. So yeah. I think that he wouldn't have succeeded any more than anyone else. This would have been the bridge too far for him. But they ended up building basically what's like a permanent world fair as the Epcot pavilion instead of what he wanted, which is like a biosphere.
Right. He wanted actual people living there. And it's interesting. And you talk a little bit about this in your book too. He sort of got, he really had this amazing mind. Like he kind of got into it with, designing the different studios, and how about underground tunnels, so if we have to bring artwork outside and it rains, we don't ruin the artwork, or if there's like that led, he almost has this like I wonder if he was on the spectrum, honestly, like I want, like he has this very interesting tunnel vision of thinking about, and it's really interesting reading your book, because I feel like there's two major Walts, right? There's the Walt, Uncle Walt, that everybody loves. And then, like, if you're a more cynical person, you're like, oh, Walt, he's an anti-Semite. Not really. Or he's a this, he's a that. He, you know, he worked with McCarthy. He's a, you know, he's either super evil or the greatest guy ever. And you talk about a guy who's just like really obsessive and often unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah, the architecture thing, there's a story that's being told with every building in terms of what it was designed for, what its use is, how people are supposed to move around in there. And I think once he spent a decade living in other people's buildings, which we all do, and he had a chance of designing his own building, he really got into it, because it's not just, I want a nice kitchen here. Oh, I want the cabinets a little lower because we have, you know, my wife is short. It's realizing, yeah, wait a minute, there's a story that's being told with every hallway and every doorway. And I want to tell this story the way I want to tell a Mickey Mouse cartoon or a silly symphony. I want to get this as the best that I can.
Yeah. Yeah. Ken, so there are so many great stories in the book. I don't mean to like make you perform, but could you tell us a story about Walt's field day?
Oh, the drunken debauchery.
Yes.
If I'm remembering it right, Walt decided that he was going to throw a one-day party for everyone, and he rented some sort of like a YMCA camp or something, and everyone drove out, and they had a great day. But these are guys just in the years after Prohibition was over. They were there, their wives were there, they had been hanging out with each other under a whole lot of stress for a long time. So it was the work hard, play hard thing, which is an expression that I really dislike, because I feel like it's a toxic thing that people say, like, we're gonna make you work 70 hours, but then we'll buy you three pizzas.
Right,
but in this case, work hard, play hard meant we are going to explode with creativity and debauchery. So there were people running around naked. There were people peeing out of second floor windows. There were people who decided, you know, my wife's here, I haven't seen her in a while. Well, we don't need to close the door before we start doing the nasty. That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm proud of the way I look. I like the way she looks. And if people want to see, that's okay.
Wow.
And Walt's wandering through this, like, what the hell did I do? This is not this is what people say Hollywood is like, you know, the Sea of Sodom of Gomorrah, and I actually made it happen at Disney.
Yeah. You know, part of me, the thing is, I feel like I love Disney. I love Mickey. I love Disney. But part of me wishes Disney wasn't so strict in its self-mythologizing. Like, was it last year or 2 years ago, Disney Plus had this documentary, like, Mickey, the Story of a Mouse.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of the same myths over again, and it's like, well, why not tell that story? Like, I really, and I know why, because it's family entertainment, and, you know, but part of me wishes there was a more adult side of Disney that said, you know what, like, we can embrace some of these more interesting things. Like let's talk about, you know, Hitler not liking Mickey Mouse, or let's talk about Walt being a chain smoker and him having smoke everywhere and smelling like smoke, and he would cough as a way of letting you know he was coming.
And for the last 30 years, Disney has been slowly working that in, but never with Mickey. They distributed Pulp Fiction back in 1994, which was a big deal, because that's a very hard R-rated movie, and it, you know, Disney's making money off of it. And now that they own Fox, they have all of those R-rated Fox movies, including a new Deadpool movie, which is going to be one of the tentpole releases of the summer. And, you know, normally you take your kids to a movie and there may be a little bit more fighting than you're used to. You can't take an 11-year-old kid to Deadpool. Which is to say, an 11-year-old kid really wants to go to Deadpool.
Right, right, right.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, like, on Disney Plus itself, I find, like, it's not easy to find some of the Fox stuff. You know, and it's like, you know, they have all, like, you know, here's a Star Wars folder, and here's the, like, why not an Alien folder? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you've bought all this stuff. You've become very near a monopoly. I don't know. It's a lucky thing.
It's something you would never normally accuse Disney of, but it's like, Disney, you're leaving so much money on the table here. Why aren't you merchandising this more? Why aren't you making this more prominent? And it's like, wait, am I accusing Disney of not slapping their logo on enough things? That seems crazy.
You're right.
I think it's an attention span thing. I think they accept the they we can only hold like 20 Disney brands in our head at any time. And if you start putting more on the table, it will dilute the brand, or some of them will just fall off the table and not get the attention that they want.
That's interesting. You talk a lot about in the book about Mickey as a character, as a persona, and how he reflects his father's and how we read him. At one point, you say something great where you say Mickey is Walt on a good day and Donald is Walt on a bad day.
Yeah, Donald is everyone on a bad day, though.
Right, but it's interesting. Donald became necessary because Mickey couldn't do things. Like, Mickey couldn't do anything. He couldn't get angry. He couldn't do any of the things that could be funny.
Yes, there were multiple times in the early 1940s where people would say, I've got a new Mickey Mouse cartoon. They'd start storyboarding it out, and they get a minute and a half into the storyboard, and then some bad fate would befall Mickey. And they realized, oh, he gets angry, and then, oh, no, wait, we can't make him get angry. That's what a normal person would do. But Mickey is a good guy, and we've painted ourselves into a wall. What happens when Mickey Mouse has a weight fall on his foot? And what happens is they just cross out Mickey Mouse's face, and they draw on Donald Duck's, and it's a Donald Duck cartoon. Right. And then Donald Duck gets angry, and you are a great Donald Duck cartoon.
And people love that.
Yeah.
Right. And Walt would call him the duck, the mouse, the duck.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough.
Yeah. Yeah. The first names weren't really used. It was that sort of I don't want to say toxic manliness, but a sort of distant manliness where you're not allowed any sort of affection to anyone else.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Like the actual employees, like, give that to the duck. He'll do that.
Yes, the way you'd say goodbye to your best friend is, well, get the hell out of here.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So you talk a little bit about, and this is something people criticize Disney for now, and because I do want to eventually get into talking about copyright and Steamboat Willie version of Mickey kind of being free for everyone now, which is that Disney took a lot. He took a lot from other people. He took a lot from other cartoons. He took a lot from vaudeville. And that's not necessarily such a indictment of him, because vaudeville, in vaudeville, people do each other's acts. Like, what's it called? Tuscaloosa Hat Company? It's a sketch that Abbott and Costello did, the Three Stooges did, and then someone else also, and they all filmed it. And nobody was getting mad at each other. But he was, and also obviously fairy tales are public domain. So it's okay kind of that he would take from everything. But the problem that people then have is when he has it, it's like, no, now it's mine. Now you
exactly.
can't have it.
Yes. Yes, I can do this. I can take fruit from all of the other trees and plant it in my garden, but you cannot take from my garden. We have intellectual property. We have a fence up around this garden. So our trees can grow, even though we took them from everyone else, but no one else can take our fruit.
Right, right. Anyone can... Disney can take an idea from anywhere, including himself. Like, I was shocked by how often he would just reuse gags from his own earlier work.
Yes, and that was actually considered a triumph of animation, to reuse a gag, because to reuse a gag, you needed to actually hold on to all of the cells, or at least the scratch paper behind it, and keep it in like a folder somewhere, and labeled enough so that you can slap it down and redraw it to have a new character take the same gag that another guy did 6 months ago. It's almost like putting ping pong balls on yourself in a green bodysuit and moving around, and you can match the motion of yourself to the character that you're moving around.
You talk about the Pluto getting stuck on the flypaper, which is like well known as like just an amazingly animated piece of work. And they did it twice. And like I found on YouTube both versions next to each other, and you can see slight improvements in the later one, but it's basically the same thing. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. The idea of recycling, which on a basic level means that if you're dancing and you throw your hand out to the left and then pull it back in and throw your hand out to the right and throw it back in, you don't need to draw all of that. You just need to draw the hand going out and then you reverse it to have the hand coming in, and then you flip the drawing and then do it again. And that way you've gotten all of this movement with only three or four drawings. So that was an economical way of having characters dance, which is why there's so much dancing in those early cartoons, because animation is expensive.
Right. It's always about cutting corners in a way.
Yeah. One of the greatest Ub Iwerks cartoons is the Skeleton Dance, where there are four skeletons dancing, and they're dancing in perfect harmony and sequence with each other. And that's because it's one drawing that's just copied three other times in a row.
Yeah. Skeleton Dance is my favorite silly symphony. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I love, like, quote unquote, dark Disney. Like, I love, like, I'm wearing a t-shirt of the Mad Doctor. I love Pluto's Dream. Is it Pluto's Dream or Pluto's Nightmare? The one where he's, like, on trial.
What was that one called? Yeah.
I love that. I love the 80s TV special, DTV, Monster Hits. I love The Haunted Mansion. That's probably my biggest fandom in Disney. So, yeah, I love the Skeleton Dance and the Skeleton Frolic, which was exactly the Skeleton Dance again, but it was Ub doing it later with his own company, I think.
That's right, yeah.
And in color.
And then later on in the same year that Skeleton Dance came out, there was, what was the one in Hell? It was Haunted
something? Hell's Bells?
Hell's Bells, yes.
Yes.
Yes, you got the name.
Yeah.
Yeah. They actually had the three-headed Cerberus dog, and each dog was a different breed. Yeah.
Huh. They don't do stuff like that anymore. But, like, there's a real, like, have you watched any of Cuphead?
The Cuphead? I've seen some Cuphead, yeah.
The villain in that is the devil. And it's sort of, that's, like, really kind of harkening back to that weird, uncanny, almost kind of scary stuff that you'd get with rubber hose animation.
Cuphead is based on Ub Iwerks' 1930s animation, the stuff that he did after he quit Disney and was working on his own.
Really?
If you look up the Balloon Man thing, and there's a pinhead devil who's popping the Balloon Man, it looks 100% like a Cuphead villain.
Wow. What do you think about that, by the way? What do you think, because you've got Cuphead, right? And then you've got the video games Bendy and the Ink Machine. And now you also have the current official Mickey, like the Mickey that you see with Mickey's Runaway Railway, is a sort of pie-eyed 1930s version. What do you think? Why is Rubber Hose coming back in some weird way?
One reason why it's coming back is because of a topic we talked about before, which is that Steamboat Willie and the early Mickey cartoons are in public domain. And one way of salting the earth to make sure, yes, it's in public domain, but no one can start a Mickey Mouse store, is by saying, well, it's in public domain, but we still have a copyright over Mickey making certain products. And if we start bringing back the pie-eyed black and white Mickey where it says circa 1928 on it, there's really no way you can make your own original free Mickey Mouse licensed merchandise without stepping on Walt and Disney's shoes, making their own identical Mickey merchandise.
Interesting. I did not think of it that way.
Yeah, think about how easy it has been to find a black and white Mickey item in the last 5 years.
Right. Because, you know, when I grew up in the 80s and 90s, it was the Fred Moore Mickey everywhere. You know, that more flesh-toned Mickey.
The dad bod Mickey. Yeah.
Yeah, the dad. Yeah, right. The Mickey that sometimes. Well, there was the Mickey. Well, I forget what. The last original Mickey cartoon. The one where he's like fishing. I forget what that's called. That's where he has eyebrows. I didn't like that Mickey, where he's too human. But the early Fred Moore stuff, like where he's like, basically when they started with Stretch and Squash, like I love that Mickey, and that Mickey was the Mickey everywhere. But you're right, now you see black and white Mickey often, and toys of black and white Mickey. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I know Bob Iger, the head of all of Disney. One of the ways that he was able to control a multi-billion dollar corporation was he said, we're only going to focus on three things at a time at this company. So we have the Muppets. Well, that's great, but Muppets are not one of our big priorities. And that's therefore, you're just not going to get Muppet stuff. Maybe a show will sneak onto Disney Plus, yeah, but they're not going to tell you about it. You're like, oh, they made a Muppet show? I had no idea.
Right.
So I think in merchandising, they were trying to only focus on a certain number of things, even if that left money on the table. You know, I would love some more Atlantis, The Last Empire gear, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It was one movie that came out, and they made a one of those direct-to-DVD sequels, and then that's it. So that's going to stay in the vault. But Mickey is perennial, so they're always going to find ways of making more Mickey stuff. And if they can also ensure that there's not going to be any competing Mickey that's coming out anytime soon, then they're making money two times, because they're making it today, and they're making 2024 money also.
Right. Well, since we're already talking about it, let's talk about what happened, because, you know, there's a long history of Mickey never being allowed into the public domain. Disney lobbying to get copyright laws changed. I mean, I believe in America, the first copyright law was 7 years plus, if you were the author was still alive, you could get another seven for a total of 14. And then it became double that, then it became the life of the author, and then it just grew. And Disney was behind. I believe the last time that Mickey was almost in the public domain was maybe the 70s or 80s. I can't remember.
I think it was the early 90s, and then they kicked 90s. The can down one more decade.
Right. And they called it the Mickey Mouse Protection Act. Because
Yeah, that's what it was nicknamed.
Right. So, but now they've let at least Steamboat Willie into the public domain, and we've got that Mickey Mouse Hunt horror movie coming out from, I believe it's the same people that made the Blood and Honey Winnie the Pooh movie.
Oh, that's supposed to be horrendous.
Yeah. And there's two Mickey horror movies, and then there's like a Mickey horror game coming out.
There were a lot of games coming out. Some of them look really good. One of them basically looks like a Toontown game, like a Roger Rabbit and Toontown, except it's all black and white, and it looks like a first person Cuphead, which is great.
Right. So what's happening is, are these people who are producing these things, are they towing a fine line, or is Disney at a point now where they're like letting things slip?
Disney has been letting things slip for decades. So there was a line in the sand, and it's a very easily known line in the sand. And people were crossing the line, and Disney would go against them. In the 90s, they got in some very bad publicity for suing a daycare center for putting an Aladdin mural up.
Yes.
And Disney realized, like, the $200 we may have saved by the Aladdin mural does not equal out all of this millions of dollars in bad publicity. I mean, we're still talking about it now.
Right.
So they decided, we're not going to make a big deal if one individual artist decides to start selling 20 copies of a print of like a Disney character. And keep in mind, all of Marvel and all of Star Wars are owned by Disney now. It's hard to draw and, you know, someone else's character without Disney eventually owning it.
Right. That's
so
true.
The line in the sand people have been crossing all the time, but this is the first time they can cross it legally. And that makes a difference, because it's one thing to say, you know, I'm going to draw Storm from the X-Men. I'm going to go to a comic convention and sell it. I'm not going to tell Disney about it. I'm not going to give Marvel any money. It's another thing to think, I'm legally within my rights to make this Mickey Mouse cartoon and sell it because it's mine. And people were much more trepidatious to not break the law than to break the law.
But do they have to stick with black and white pie eye Mickey? Like, if it was, you know, Fred Moore Mickey in this Mickey horror movie, could Disney go after them? Or even if they could, would they?
Legally, yes, they could go after them. The only thing in the public domain right now are the first three Mickey cartoons. Those are Plain Crazy and Gallopin' Gaucho, which were made as Silence, and then Steamboat Willie, which is the one that everyone knows, which became a big hit. And they've added sound to the first two of them, but that's the box of contents. You can take Mickey from those three things and the elements of those three things and turn those into cartoons and or whatever else you want to do.
Right.
And you can legally use those toys in that sandbox.
So it's not Mickey Mouse, the character. It's those texts, it's those shorts.
It's those shorts. Yes. You could expand upon them, but we talked about before about how Mickey is kissing girls he shouldn't be doing and beating up animals. That is the Mickey Mouse that you have to expand on to say, you want to see more adventures of this guy? And people are like, no, I don't want to see Mickey Mouse in doing frat night roofie experiments with people. Yeah.
Right. Accidentally shooting Pluto. Do you remember the movie Escape from Tomorrow? It was a independent movie that was
the one that was filmed on the sly.
Yes, at Disneyland, yes. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that was a big deal, and that Disney didn't. I don't think they went after them. I think
no,
which is wild, really.
Do you know the Streisand effect?
No.
Okay, so Barbara Streisand has a house on the Pacific Ocean, and a group of erosion people working with the State Geological Society wanted to take pictures of erosion damage. So they wanted to take pictures of everything along the coast, but they needed to tell all the homeowners, we're going to take pictures of your coastline. Hope that's okay. You were officially allowed to protest this if you didn't, for whatever reason, want your backyard taken a picture of. And Barbara Streisand protested because she's a famous person and she didn't want her backyard, she paid good money for this, and she didn't want it to become public information. However, that backfired spectacularly because all of a sudden now Barbara Streisand is suing this Geological Society and everyone writes about it and everyone then takes their own pictures of her backyard and everyone now knows where she lives. So what she was trying to do completely failed.
Wow.
And so that's the Streisand effect. So Disney realizes almost anything it does to stop Mickey Mouse promulgating is going to Streisand effect back on them. So they let Escape from Tomorrow go out. And if they had tried to stop it, it would have been a story, but they didn't. Right. So only you and I remember it. Most people have forgotten about it.
Because it's not a very good movie, other than it's one little gimmick.
Right.
That's such an interesting point. They've gotten smarter. Really, at how they're protecting the intellectual property.
Right. And if you think about protecting intellectual property in terms of I want to get paid every time you use, one of my characters, they're probably, if I was drawing copies of Storm and selling them at conventions and Disney said you got to pay me $12 whenever I do that, I would simply stop doing that. Disney's not going to get my $12. I'll draw something else. So Disney realizes that there's not much money coming in if they start to enforce this law, but there'll be fewer Storm characters out in the world. So it's free advertising for them to not enforce the law.
Right. I think with these cheesy movies like Mickey's Mousetrap, and I think all of that stuff is the sort of first wave. But what I hope happens, and what I think might happen, is once we shake that off, once that initial reaction happens, there might be some better, more interesting stuff. Because I do believe in the public domain. I do believe that, I believe that an artist or a creator should be able to live off of what they create. But I also feel like, an idea that's almost 100 years old or is 100 years old should be something that we could all like. If I have to deal with Mickey every day, if Mickey's a part of the world I live in, I should be able to play with him too.
Yes.
And I think there's some great stuff historically, like the Air Pirates. I don't know if you talk about it in the book, but the Air Pirate comics.
I read all of those. Yes, that Floyd Gottfredson did. Yeah, those are such good fun. And that's basically where Tailspin came from, which is one of my favorite Disney afternoon cartoons.
No, not the official comics. There was a group of in the 60s. There was a group of
I know what you're talking about.
Culture artists. They ended up getting sued. They were called the Air Pirates. And their comics would be Mickey was having sex with Minnie. Mickey was shooting people and killing people. They ended up going to court. You could find some of the footage online. I think it's even in, there's a movie called Rip, a Remix Manifesto, which is about culture and public domain. And they show a lot of it in that movie. And the judge was like, what gives you the right to use Mickey Mouse? And they were like, nothing gives us the right. I wanted to, and I stole them fair and square. So they were like real hippies, you know what I mean? But it's interesting stuff. I guess a more mainstream example would be like the way Mickey's depicted in South Park.
Yes, and that's a great example of how even if Winnie the Pooh wasn't in public domain, you could still put out Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey,
right?
Because that is so far removed from the version of Winnie the Pooh. Oh, my head stuck in the jar again.
Right.
That it counts as parody, even though it's like a gross, dark, disturbing horror movie. But that version of Winnie the Pooh is so far removed, it's a parodic version. So any version of Mickey Mouse you come up with, which is really far removed from what Walt is doing, that counts as a parody.
Right.
Or it could count as a parody for
Right, that's the problem,
legal.
Though. Right, the problem is free use is such a it's such a vague legal definition that you can even, you know, you could say you could still get yourself in court basically if even if you say like this is the first, you know, oh I'm this is the First Amendment, I'm just parroting something. But there are, I've loved Mickey as an icon. Like I love like Keith Haring's Mickey, or you know, different artists that interpret Mickey. Banksy has used Mickey in different ways. Like to me, and I'm not somebody who's like hates Mickey, like, or hates Disney, or feel, or hates, you know, thinks they're the worst thing ever. Like to me, I feel like that's what culture is. Like Mickey is a part of our lives, and he represents something about us, and we think about him. So why shouldn't he be all these different things? You know what I mean?
Right. If we were 300 years ago and we were in a world where religion was a much more important aspect of our lives day to day, we would be talking about the saints and the martyrs, and we'd see lots of Mickey in all of those martyrs. Those would be all of our characters we were talking about. If we were 3,000 years ago in Greece, we'd be talking about all the demigods, and that's who we'd be talking about. If we were less, just like, I don't know, 30 years ago, we'd be talking about various superheroes. But Mickey is someone who we can always connect with on that mythical level, because we've imbued in him these sterling values. And he's just just a good little guy. He's a good little guy who's doing the right thing all the time.
Right, right, right. In the newest Mickey, not the Mickey Clubhouse, because that's for a young audience, but the Wonderful World of Mickey shorts by the producer Paul Rudish. They've actually, I think, in a way that I like, they've given him a character where he's very neurotic and very nervous and scared. And I feel like that was a good turn from like being so good and so sweet to like he's afraid of the world. Are you familiar with those at all?
Yes, yes, they're like a flash animation almost.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and Chris Dimantopoulos is the voice. And if you look up what else he's done, it's like, oh, wait, that's Russ, the slimy skis bag from Silicon Valley. And that's also Mo Howard from the Three Stooges live action movie. Like, he is such a crazy IMDb page. And among all these other things, he's a current voice of Mickey Mouse.
I know. And what a flex. I mean, what a crazy thing to be, to have on your resume. So some of the weird things, Mickey, his first, let's say, live action appearance is he's in March of the Wooden Soldiers or Babes in Toyland, played by, I think, a spider monkey.
Yeah.
And I remember this as a kid, and it's almost like a fever dream. Like, did that actually happen? I was going to say
sleep paralysis nightmare, but fever dream is the same thing. Yeah.
It's Mickey. It's very weird.
And if you didn't tell people that it was his face on a monkey, people would like look it up and be horrified, because like what person looks like that? What did they do to that poor carnival freak to put them in a Mickey mask? Why are they moving the way they're moving? Oh, they put the mask on a monkey.
So are there any aspects of Mickey's history that you weren't able to fit into the book?
I had originally imagined that I was going to talk a lot more about Disney's failures over the years. Mm. Like for about 30 years straight, they had a series of next steps after Walt Disney World. They were going to build an America theme park in Virginia. They were going to build something called Mountain King in California as a ski slope. And they had a whole lot of these that they were thinking of. There was something in Times Square, and they cleaned up Times Square, but they didn't build what they wanted to build in Times Square. Mm. So they had about a 30-year record of, in terms of structures, in terms of going places and coming up with tourist traps, that they were not doing very well.
Yeah.
So then I was thinking about talking about Disney over the decades, not just in the Walt and Oob years, which basically end with World War II. At least that's where I ended telling the story. But I really wanted to keep the focus on the three of them. I thought of it like a braid, where you're learning about the business history of Disney over the decades, but also the personal biography of Walt and Oob, and also the cultural history of Mickey Mouse. And they're all intertwined. You can't really tell one without the other two.
And I think descendants of Oob do stuff with Disney, right? Isn't Leslie Iwerks a documentarian?
Yes, and she's made some fantastic documentaries, including one about Oob Iwerks called The Hand Behind the Mouse, and she wrote a corresponding book with that also.
Oh, I have not seen that. I want to bring Oob back. Are you familiar with the campaign a few years ago that was successful to get Bill Finger reestablished as a co-creator of Batman?
Yes, every Batman comic you read now says Batman created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger.
They still use Oob and they still say Oob, created, but I want people to know Oob more. I want
Mickey Mouse
justice
created
to
by Oob Iwerks with Walt Disney.
Yeah, or Walt can go first. Walt can go first. Well, I love how Walt, when they were going to work together, it was the two of them. Walt, he let it be Iwerks Disney because he thought Disney Iwerks sounded like
an optician shop.
So even that, I love that. You make a really, there's something really interesting you talk about, which is how even when they're trying to do different things, Walt is no longer, I mean, he hasn't animated in a million years, but he's no longer directing. He's no longer writing. He's got his mind on all this expansion. Still, Mickey's like a guiding light. Like, you talk about how they're having trouble animating Pinocchio, the character, and Bambi, the character. And you talk in the book about how turning to lessons they learned from Mickey ends up fixing those issues.
Yes, it fixes the issues, but at the price of they've taken everything special about Mickey and they've given it out. So Pinocchio has a lot of how Mickey moves and Mickey's size and scale and dimensions and the big hands of it all and how he feels like a kid. And Bambi has a naturalism to it also. And there was some naturalism to how Mickey Mouse was moving around in the world, and how the world moved. Even if Mickey was a cartoon, the world was more realistic. And they took all of these lessons, like you said, from Mickey, but those lessons used to be why people watched Mickey Mouse cartoons. Right. Now they're disseminated throughout everything else in Disney, which meant that there wasn't anything that special about Mickey himself.
Right. I think younger people would be surprised to know that there was a time, I mean, Mickey was always there, but there was a time where he was not top dog or top mouse. I mean, there was a time where Donald is a star now, and maybe we'll do one Mickey short, or Mickey will be in an ad for something, or the comic, the comics, which is an interesting thing that I think a lot of people don't know about. The comic strip is going the whole time, but there was a time where Mickey's like, there's almost talks of like, do we even get rid of him? And Walt never would. Walt was like, no, we have to keep him around. He's essential.
Right. It's like a sitcom at the end of its reign. We've had 8 or 9 good years. Do we want to keep on going forever? Do we want to see these people turn into old men and old ladies? And Walt realized, like, we never don't have to age Mickey. We can keep Mickey perpetually young. We can have all these new adventures for him. And it's not scratching the itch of something new. It's scratching the itch of something old and familiar.
Yes. And of course, and you point out in the book that even when they're not making Mickey shorts, the merchandising is still bringing in money.
Yes. If you didn't have time to listen to this whole hour-long podcast, and if you didn't have time to do the whole book, the why Walt Disney is successful is because Mickey was making them so much money that they could then plow that money into all of the other cartoons. Sometimes Mickey cartoons, sometimes Donald, sometimes Silly Symphonies, sometimes features, but that was an endless river of money coming in that Walt loved to then send right back out.
Right. And it's never stopped.
No.
I mean, look,
no,
in any speech you're in, look for Mickey. Like, Mickey, he's on your watch. He's on your shirt. Like, Mickey is still everywhere.
Right. He's on your shirt right now, in fact.
Yeah, he's on my shirt right now, yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, are you, not just Disney, but just in general nerddom, do you collect things?
I have never really found anything to collect. When I was a kid, I collected comic books.
Yeah.
And I thought about baseball cards, but I was just more into comics. And I stopped because it got too expensive, and I was going on to college, and I didn't want to spend like $35 a week on, you know, my weekly pulls. But I realized I loved reading comics, and I didn't necessarily need to own them. So long as I found a way of reading them by, you know, sponging off of friends or going to the library or finding them online, all of those were satisfactory ways for me to read comics. But collecting is something that I've always been looking for things to collect, but I've never found it. I'm still looking. I'm still chasing what to collect instead of chasing the collection.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Don't then, because let me tell you, it's a lot of money. And if you're not bitten by that bug yet, go ahead and be happy. I want to show this is an audio medium, but I want to show you something of my collection. This is my favorite Mickey. This is a Gabriel mechanic Mickey Mouse. You wind him up on the back and you can see his innards.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I believe it's from 1978. I got it for a steal. I got it for like $5 because the person who had it didn't know what they had. You can find them on eBay for like at least 100. I have tons of I'm drowning under bullshit. So go, you know, you're probably having a healthier life than I do.
Well, I have noticed that there is a thing where the thing you want to collect, the want is more than the scratch that's itched. I keep on saying that phrase. When you get it, like, I've had friends who have wanted a certain issue of a comic, and they look for 10 years for it, and they find it, and they get it, and it's great. They put it, and they still look for that comic because they forgot that they got it.
Yes, yes. I was, at one point in my life, I was so deep into Star Wars action figures, three and three-quarter inch action figures, that I had to tell myself, because I would find a figure and I go, wait, do I have that? And I'd say, you know what? The new rule is, if you're not even sure if you have it already, you can't buy it. because you'd be buying doubles of things, or you didn't really need it, right? Because if you have it already and you're excited to see it, you're right. It's the gathering of it.
Right. What's 88 times two?
right.
Ig 672.
So tell me about your latest book, the Princess Leia book.
Oh, wow. We just segged into Star Wars. That was very clever there. Nice. So I'd written about in Super Mario, I wrote about one creative force in Shigeru Miyamoto making one great iconic character in Super Mario. And then when I wrote about Mickey, I wrote about two creators with one character. And one of the creators became a Steve Jobs and one of them became a Steve Wozniak.
Yes.
And so I wanted to then write about an actor and a role where the role ended up overshadowing the actor. And I thought about doing something with a sitcom star. Like if you think of Jenna Fisher from The Office, she played Pam. Every day of her life, someone is going to call her Pam, even though that show went off the air 15 years ago.
Right.
And she needs to live with that. And I'm sure she's fine with it. I'm sure the royalty checks don't hurt either.
Right.
But in terms of getting a chance to like keep on acting and have the world know who you are, the world kind of already knows who you are from this character because it's overshadowing everything else you could bring to the stage or screen. So I wanted to write about a role like that. And I also love Star Wars, so I decided eventually I could write about Carrie Fisher and Princess Leia, and I'd have that connection, the character and the role. And Carrie Fisher did so much in her life that hardly anyone knows about. Mm-hmm. So I was able to not tell a story about this poor lady who could never act again. But this is a lady who wrote a number one best-selling book, which became a number one box office film, and then for a decade was one of the biggest script doctors in Hollywood, all because no one saw her. She was in disguise as Leia the whole time.
Yeah, it's she really, and I think she had a very healthy attitude about it. She sort of she seemed to not mind being associated with Leia.
I think that was a long, hard-fought way of saying I don't mind it. I think for about 20 years she did mind it, but it was a sort of a tension that on one hand you're like no, on the other hand yes. So she, it was happening and she couldn't stop it, so she learned to accept it.
Well, Leonard Nimoy wrote two memoirs, and the first one's called I'm Not Spock, and then I think the last one is called I Am Spock.
Yes.
So that you see a journey there with him. Like, you know what? I am Spock. Why not?
You know, I was thinking about writing a memoir called I Am Not Spock, because I'm not Spock. You're not Spock either. You could write that one.
Right. No one really is, in fact.
Except, I guess, Benjamin Spock, the pediatrician.
Yes.
He's the one person who couldn't write that book. Everyone else was legally able to use that title.
He was the baby book, right? What was the name of that book? Was he
Dr. Spock's Baby and Child Care, I think.
Dr. Spock. Deep cut. Speaking of deep cuts, I knew I was going to like you when I was reading this book. On page 165, I forget what you were referencing, but you make a Mystery Science Theater 3000 reference. Just repeat yourself, it's just a show. I should really just relax. I was like, this guy speaks my language.
I snuck that in there, and most people weren't going to get it, but I salute you. You're the first person who caught that MST3K really? Reference. Really? Yes.
That's incredible. One question I had, we'll wrap up soon, but I wanted to ask you, is what was the reason to not do like footnotes or endnotes? Because you obviously have a ton of information.
Yes. I actually did write that book with footnotes. There's a woman named Mary Roach who writes science books, and she has fantastic, tremendous footnotes. And I wanted to write footnotes like that, so I gave it a try. And then I gave the book to my publisher, who said, the book is too long. You got to cut some stuff. Okay. And the very first thing that you would cut then are the footnotes, because by definition, they're not essential to the story.
Right.
And I hate to say it, because I want to say, no, I'm right there, wrong. You know, the book would have been better with an extra 20,000 words in it. But I can't remember hardly anything that was there in the footnotes. It all disappeared from my memory. All the stuff I thought was so important that needed to be there. Once it was gone, it's like, oh, this is moving slower. What helped me in cutting it? You were around when DVDs first came out, right?
Yeah.
All of the deleted scenes, and it would be such a big deal. I get to watch all these Martin Scorsese deleted scenes, but not every film is a Martin Scorsese film. A lot of times you would watch the deleted scenes, you'd be like, yeah, I know why they deleted that. I figured why they deleted that. Yeah, that was 2.5 minutes in a comedy where I didn't laugh once. I get why you cut that scene.
Yeah, I remember when I was in grad school, I did a lot of footnotes on a paper once, and the professor was like, cut it. And I was like, well, it's important. And he was like, okay, then put it in the text. And I was like, well, it's not important enough for the text. He's like, okay, then you can cut it. Like, it's very simple. If it's important, put it in it. If not, if you really just want to go on a digression, then it's not necessary.
Yeah, but having to cut words really, really helped me, not just with editing, but with the philosophy of editing.
Yeah.
Looking at each sentence as, this is an 18-word sentence. How many words do I need to keep the ideas in this sentence? Could I do it in 15 words? Can I cut 3 words out of this sentence? Because that'll help. That's 3 words that I now don't need to cut from a more important sentence later on.
Yeah. I think, is it Stephen King on writing where he says, you know, you could shut the door or you could shut the door aggressively, but neither is better than I slam the door.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. If you can get your 17-word sentence down to 12, and it's like, this is an even better sentence. And each word you use is not wasting the reader's time, but is using the reader's time. And the reader's time is valuable. So, you know, it's a privilege to have a book picked up and someone decides this is a book I'm going to read. And I want to honor that reader's time by not boring them with 19 pages where it's like, it's kind of good around page 20. So just bear with me through 19 pages of dross.
I can tell you, let's start
on page 20.
Your books are very good. You've got a real snappy style. Your books are very, very consumable. I think anybody who likes this podcast will like your books. Can you tell me, what are you working on now, or what are you working on next?
In June, I have a book, the Your Worshipfulness, that's coming out.
It's not out yet. Oh, okay.
I did a Kickstarter for it, but it's officially going to be coming out later on this year, which is why if you Google it, it doesn't really come up. Because I was planning on doing the whole self-publishing gambit of listing it myself on Amazon and hiring someone to read it for the audiobook. And then a publisher picked it up. It's like, oh, I don't have to do that anymore. But I'm now on the publisher schedule, which means it's coming out when the publisher wants, which is in 3 months. I have no problem with that because they're doing all the work. And then later on this year, I have a whole other book about Spider-Man and the artists who draw Spider-Man called Father and Son Issues, The Secret History of Spider-Man.
Interesting. So it's funny because when I was thinking about Oob, I was thinking also about Ditko.
Yes. Yeah, I have a whole chapter about Steve Ditko.
Yeah.
But the book mostly focuses on John Romita Sr. and John Jr. Oh,
okay.
If you are a Spider-Man head, you know who those people are.
Yes. Very cool. All right. So you write cool books. Thank you so much for being here. I like to ask people what they're currently obsessed with. What's the thing that you're reading now, watching now, playing now that... You know, it's maybe you're binge watching it. It's something that's on your mind. What's the thing you're currently obsessed with?
Oh, you asked me the wrong question. I'm going to bore you out of the room with this one. I read a book last week all about parking and how parking explains the world. That was the subtitle of it.
Parking?
Like parking. Yeah, like park cars and parking lots and all of that.
Really?
Yes, they talk about how whenever you build a new structure, you need to account for parking, and you need to build a huge parking garage next to your building, but that parking garage is going to be mostly empty all the time, so it's an expense that the builders don't need. If you count 1,000 parking spaces in your town, maybe 950 of them are going to be empty at any given time. But we account for so much of parking. And if we don't get a spot right away that's close and free right next to where we want, we get, oh, I can't believe I can't park it. Yeah. It makes you feel like there's a moral crime against you that you need to park, you know, a 20-second walk away.
That's so true.
We're all part of the problem with parking right in front of everywhere we want to be.
Yeah, it's true. I got to say, I'm spoiled. My partner is has a handicap, so we can park. We park close. I've gotten very used to parking close with her. So I no longer think about your little people issues. But thank you.
Our little people issues.
Jeff Ryan, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for talking to us about Oob Iwerks and Mickey Mouse. We end every episode of our podcast by quoting the great Animal from Muppet Babies. He would say, go bye-bye. Could you say go bye-bye for us?
Should I do it in the animal voice?
If you can, that's fantastic.
Go bye-bye.